A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been reading clinical trial write-ups again, and he hit the wall every smart layperson hits. You're following the prose fine, then the results section starts throwing around. Sensitivity, specificity, standard deviation, effect size, risk ratio, and you're supposed to just know what those mean. He wants a field guide. Not a statistics course, but enough to actually read a paper and know whether the finding is real, how big it is, and whether it applies to you.
And the thing is, these terms aren't hard because they're complicated. They're hard because each one answers a different question, and papers never label which question they're answering. You're just expected to notice that sensitivity and specificity are about the test, not the patient, and that a risk ratio of 0.6 means something completely different depending on how common the bad outcome was to begin with.
So, let's do what Daniel actually asked. Walk through the diagnostic pair first, then the how big and how certain trio, then the risk family, and at every step, name the question the number is actually answering, because that's what most explainers skip.
Sensitivity and specificity. Every diagnostic test makes two different mistakes. It can miss someone who has the disease, that's a false negative, or it can flag someone who's healthy, that's a false positive. Sensitivity is the share of people who truly have the condition that the test correctly catches. Specificity is the share of people who truly don't have it that the test correctly clears.
So a test with 90% sensitivity catches 9 out of 10 sick people and tells one sick person they're fine. 90% specificity clears 9 out of 10 healthy people and scares one healthy person into a follow-up.
Right, and here's the part people miss. Both numbers are calculated within a single disease status group. Sensitivity only looks at the sick column. Specificity only looks at the healthy column. That's why they're properties of the test itself, and they don't change when the disease gets more or less common in the population. A 90% sensitive test is 90% sensitive whether you're screening a million people or testing one patient in a specialist clinic.
That's the setup for the trap that actually matters, because there's another pair of numbers, positive predictive value and negative predictive value, and those do change with prevalence. They're the ones that answer the question a patient actually asks, which is, I tested positive, what are the odds I really have it?
And the example that makes this click is brutal. Take a test that's 90% sensitive and 90% specific. Sounds excellent. In a specialist clinic where half the people being tested actually have the disease, a positive result means you're 90% likely to be a true case. Same test, same sensitivity, same specificity, but now you're screening the general population and only 1% of people have the condition. A positive result now means you're 8.3% likely to be a true case.
8.3, same test. The only thing that changed is who you pointed it at.
That's the prevalence paradox. It's why a COVID antigen test behaved differently in a hospital ward than in a random airport screening line. It's why a cancer screen that looks great in a high-risk trial can generate a flood of false alarms in the wild. The test didn't get worse. The crowd got healthier.
There's a mnemonic I actually like for the two error directions. Snout. A highly sensitive test, when negative, rules out disease. Because if it's very good at catching true cases, and it says you're clear, you're probably clear. The other one is S-peepin, a highly specific test when positive rules in disease. Because if it's very good at not flagging healthy people, and it flags you, you're probably not a false alarm.
And notice neither mnemonic says anything about the other error type. A highly sensitive test can still have terrible specificity. It catches almost all the sick people, but also flags half the healthy ones. A highly specific test can have lousy sensitivity. It almost never false alarms, but it misses a lot of true cases. You can't tell from one number whether the other one is any good.
They also trade off against each other. You can move the threshold, the cutoff for what counts as a positive result, and as you catch more true cases, you also catch more false alarms. Raising sensitivity lowers specificity. The only way to improve both is a better test, not a different cutoff on the same one.
And if you want one number that combines both, you look at the area under the ROC curve, the AUC. 0.5 is no better than flipping a coin. 1.0 is perfect. Above 0.8 is generally considered clinically useful. Below that, limited utility. But AUC hides the threshold question. Two tests can have the same AUC and behave very differently at the cutoff a doctor actually uses.
So that's the diagnostic pair. The test has two error rates, they're properties of the test, and they don't tell you what a positive result means for you unless you also know how common the disease is in your group.
Next chunk Daniel asked about, standard deviation, control group size, effect size. These are the how big and how certain numbers.
Standard deviation is the one most people half remember from school and then freeze on. It's just spread. How far individual values typically sit from the group average. A small standard deviation means everyone bunched up near the mean. A large one means the group was all over the place.
And it matters because an average without a spread is nearly useless. If a drug lowers blood pressure by 10 points on average, but the standard deviation is 20 points, that means some patients dropped 30 points and some went up 10. The average is real, but it's not the experience of any particular patient. Whereas if the standard deviation is 2 points, almost everyone got close to that 10-point drop.
Control group size is Daniel's phrase, and it's not a name statistic, but the underlying point is power. How many people do you need in each group to actually detect a real difference if one exists?
Small samples produce unstable results. 10 people having a bad drug reaction means something very different in a 100-person study than in a 100,000-person study. Denominators matter. And a study with too few people can't detect a real effect even when it's there. That's a type 2 error, concluding there's no effect when one actually exists.
The convention is you want statistical power of at least 80%. That means if there's a real difference, the study has an 80% chance of finding it. Below that, a negative result is hard to interpret. It might mean there's no effect, or it might mean the study was too small to see one.
And here's the thing that connects back to effect size. You can't calculate how many people you need without first estimating how big the effect is. A huge effect needs a small sample. A tiny effect needs an enormous one. So effect size isn't just a reporting nicety, it's the number that drives study design from the start.
Effect size itself is the magnitude of a finding, separate from whether it's statistically significant. A result can be statistically significant, meaning unlikely to be chance, and still be so small that no patient would notice or care.
The most common measure is Cohen's D. It's the difference between two group means expressed in units of the pooled standard deviation. A D of 1.0 means the two groups are one standard deviation apart. The famous thresholds are 0.2 small, 0.5 medium, 0.8 large.
But those thresholds are a rule of thumb that hardened into dogma. Cohen himself called them arbitrary, a fallback for when a field has no better basis, and different fields have different baselines. Psychology's published average is closer to D of 0.4. Education uses 0.2, 0.4, 0.6. In clinical medicine, a small effect on Cohen's generic scale can still be a life-saving difference at population scale.
A D of 0.5 in a medical trial is a big deal. The same D of 0.5 in a personality psychology study sits near the average effect the field routinely publishes. Context beats thresholds every time.
Which is why the p-value alone is a trap. A paper can report p less than 0.05, and you still know nothing about whether the finding is big enough to matter. The p-value tells you the result is unlikely to be noise. The effect size tells you whether it's worth your attention.
There's also a correction for small samples called Hedges G. With two groups of 8 people each, a D of 0.58 drops to about 0.55. Once you get above 20 per group, they're nearly identical. It's a small sample adjustment, and it's one of those details that tells you the authors actually thought about their numbers.
Now the risk family, which is where the safety and probability language lives. Risk ratio, also called relative risk. It's the proportion with a bad outcome in the treated group divided by the proportion in the control group.
Above 1 means the treatment increases risk. Below 1 means it decreases risk. Exactly 1 means no change. Worked example, 20% of controls develop a bad outcome, 12% of treated do. risk ratio is 0.6. That's a 40% relative risk reduction.
And this is where headlines go to die. Because relative risk reduction sounds enormous, an absolute risk reduction is often tiny. A relative risk of 0.5 can mean a drop from 50% to 25%, or from 10% to 5%, or from 1% to 0.5%. Same relative risk. Wildly different real-world magnitudes.
The Ascot trial is the classic. 36% relative risk reduction in cardiac events. Sounds like a miracle drug. The absolute risk reduction was 1.1%. The drug took a small risk and made it slightly smaller, and the relative framing made it sound like it eliminated a third of all heart attacks.
Absolute risk reduction is just control risk minus treatment risk. In that example, if the control group had a 3% event rate and the treated group had 2%, the absolute reduction is 1%. Number needed to treat is 100 divided by that. So, NNT of 100. You treat 100 people to prevent one event.
And the FPM refresher. Daniel's probably been circling gives the full picture. Relative risk of 0.85. Relative risk reduction of 15%. Absolute risk reduction of 3%. NNT of 33 over 4 years. For every 33 people who take the medicine for 4 years, one person avoids one of the outcomes.
Then you look at which outcome. In that example, the composite benefit was driven almost entirely by hospitalization for heart failure. 2.4% of the 3% absolute reduction was that one outcome. The NNT for that single outcome was 42, at $24,000 per person over 4 years. That's just over $1 million to prevent one hospitalization.
Composite outcomes are their own trap. The manufacturer advertises that the drug reduced the likelihood of death, stroke, heart attack, and hospitalization by 15%. It actually did nothing of the sort. It reduced hospitalization, and the other three outcomes were along for the ride.
Odds ratio is the one that even journal authors get wrong. It's not the same as risk ratio. When the outcome is rare, they're close enough. When the outcome is common, the odds ratio diverges substantially and overstates the effect.
Multiple papers have documented this as a recognized error. Odds ratios are hard to comprehend directly and are routinely interpreted as equivalent to relative risk. When the outcome is common, that mistake can seriously affect treatment decisions and policy.
So, if you're reading a paper and it reports an odds ratio of 2.5, and the outcome happened in 40% of the control group, you can't say the treatment more than doubled the risk. The actual risk ratio is smaller. How much smaller depends on the baseline rate.
The rule of thumb, if the outcome is under about 10%, odds ratio and risk ratio are close enough that it doesn't matter much. If the outcome is common, demand the actual risk ratio or recalculate from the raw numbers.
There's also number needed to harm, which is the same logic in reverse. For the Alzheimer's monoclonal antibodies, the number needed to harm for brain swelling was 9. 9 people treated, one case of ARIA edema. For symptomatic brain swelling, it was 86.
And the benefit side was sobering. Lecanemab produced a 1.8-point improvement on a cognitive scale, where the minimal clinically important difference is 5 points on a 90-point scale. So the benefit was real, statistically detectable, and too small for most patients to notice. That's the gap between statistical significance and clinical significance in one drug.
Minimal clinically important difference is worth naming on its own. Generally, a change of at least 8 to 10% in a symptom score before patients actually notice feeling better. Below that, you've got a number that moved, but a patient who can't tell.
Confidence intervals deserve a moment too, because they're the uncertainty band around every one of these numbers. Sampling 10 students and finding 4 men gives a 95% confidence interval of 12 to 74% men. Sampling 1,000 and finding 400 gives 37 to 43%. Same point estimate, wildly different precision.
The confidence interval is the honest version of the finding. A wide interval means the study doesn't know much. A narrow one means it pinned the number down. Any paper that reports a point estimate without a confidence interval is asking you to trust a guess.
And the reading strategy Daniel's actually going to use. Skip the methods unless you're hunting for a specific detail. Skim the abstract. Read the introduction. The last sentences state the objective. Then results and discussion, first and last paragraphs of the discussion give the highlights. Then, limitations.
Watch the language. Associated with or linked to means correlation, not causation. The ability to derive causation comes from study design and the totality of evidence, not one observational study.
Check the journal. Predatory journals collect fees without real review. Check the publication date. Check the number of participants. Check who was enrolled, because a trial on 40-year-old men tells you nothing about 70-year-old women. Check conflicts of interest. If there are no declarations in the paper, assume there could be conflicts among authors.
Preprints aren't peer-reviewed. They're fine for following a field, but they shouldn't be used to support clinical practice or individual health behavior.
The through line. Sensitivity and specificity are about the test's two error rates. Standard deviation is spread. Control group size is power. Effect size is magnitude, separate from significance. Risk ratio is relative risk. Absolute risk reduction is the real-world number. Number needed to treat is how many people you treat to help one. Odds ratio is the imposter that overstates common outcomes.
The single most counterintuitive fact in the whole bundle is the prevalence paradox. The same 90-90 test is trustworthy in a specialist clinic and nearly useless as a population screen. The test didn't change. The crowd did.
If there's one habit that would fix most misreadings, it's asking which question the number is answering. Is this telling me about the test, the spread, the size of the effect, or the risk? Because each of those is a different question, and the paper won't tell you which one you're holding.
Daniel's going to be reading these papers with a different set of eyes now. The next time he sees a 36% reduction, he's going to ask, reduction from what to what?
0.8.
What?
The AUC threshold. You said above 0.8 is clinically useful. The Turkish review says 0.80 or above is generally considered useful. Below that, limited utility. It's 0.80, not 0.8.
Fair correction. 0.80.
I own one of those pulse oximeters, the kind that clips on your finger. Bought it in 98 after my brother-in-law had a scare. It reads oxygen saturation. Sensitivity's fine, specificity's fine, but the display only shows whole numbers. 95, 96. It never shows 95.5. So you're sitting there watching a number that's rounding itself and you're supposed to feel reassured.
That's actually a real limitation. The device is averaging and rounding, and the error band on a consumer pulse oximeter is typically plus or minus 2%. So a reading of 95 could be 93.
That's what I told him. He said the doctor said it was fine. I said the doctor's reading a better machine. He kept it on the nightstand for 6 years, then the battery corroded and he threw it out.
The rounding point connects to confidence intervals. The machine's giving you a point estimate with no interval. You're trusting a number that's been quietly rounded by firmware.
Firmware. My pulse oximeter doesn't have firmware. It has a battery and a spring. The spring's the part that fails first. After that, it clips on but doesn't grip. You'd get a reading of 91, and it's just the clip slipping.
Which is a measurement error, not a clinical change. That's the other thing about these numbers. They assume the measurement itself is reliable. If the device is drifting, the sensitivity and specificity from the validation study don't apply to your unit.
They validated it on a bench in a lab with a calibrated gas mixture. My brother-in-law's was sitting in a drawer with loose batteries for 2 years. Different instrument.
The instrument drift point is underrated. A test's published sensitivity is what it did in the validation study under controlled conditions. What it does in your clinic with a tired technician and a machine that hasn't been recalibrated is a different question.
You want the real-world sensitivity? You test it in the real world. Nobody wants to pay for that study. So they quote the lab number and call it a day.
He's right. That's a known gap between efficacy and effectiveness. Efficacy is what the test does under ideal conditions. Effectiveness is what it does in practice. Most published sensitivity and specificity numbers are efficacy numbers.
My brother-in-law's fine, by the way. It was a panic attack. The oximeter said 91 because the clip was loose, and he panicked harder, which made his breathing worse, which made the reading worse. The instrument created the symptom it was measuring.
That's a feedback loop you don't see in the validation study.
He sold it at a yard sale for $4. Told the buyer it worked fine. I didn't say anything.
The yard sale disclosure is its own study design problem. No blinding, no control group, and one participant with a conflict of interest.
That's the whole episode in miniature. A number, a missing interval, a measurement error, and someone trusting the point estimate.
The misconception I'd name is that a statistically significant result is the same as a meaningful one. People see P less than 0.05 and think the finding is real, big, and applies to them. The p-value only tells you it's probably not noise. The effect size tells you if it's big enough to notice. The confidence interval tells you how precisely you know it. The absolute risk tells you if it matters in the real world. Four different questions, four different numbers, and the paper only hands you the p-value with a triumphant tone.
The fix is the question Daniel's now equipped to ask. Significant for whom? Measured how? Over what baseline? With what interval? If the paper can't answer those, the headline number is doing a lot of unearned work.
The forward question I'd leave with, there's a gap in the literature Daniel just exposed. Nobody has bundled sensitivity, specificity, effect size, and risk ratio into one layperson's field guide. The material is scattered across diagnostic testing guides, RCT interpretation refreshers, and effect size explainers. Daniel might be the person to write the thing he was looking for.
That's a project for another day. For now, he can read the results section without flinching, and that was the ask.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com, and we'll be back soon.
Until then, check the denominator.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.